previously on Popping Collars.
Did you kind of sit on a stool? It's just, I do
Noah
not, you don't look good that way. Noah looks good that way. Everybody, go home. Right, just sit on a stool, naked, in front of your mirror, a real exploratory moment for yourself, perhaps.
Consciousness raising right here. No one
looks good naked. That's why there aren't mirrors directly in front of toilets. No one, PSA. No one looks good naked like that. Welcome to Poppin' Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection of meaning and culture. My name is Betsy Gonzalez, and I'm currently serving as the head chaplain at Episcopal High School in Alexandria, Virginia. With me tonight is Greg Knight. Greg, where are you and what are you up to?
Hi, Betsy. I am in beautiful Palm Beach, Florida, where I'm the director of Children and Youth Ministries at the Church of Bethesda by the Sea.
Excellent. Also here is Ricardo Avila. Ricardo, where are you? What are you up to?
Well, I am exactly right now in San Mateo, California, in the Bay Area, visiting my husband on vacation between Christmas and New Year's. But normally I reside as interim rector at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in lovely Long Beach, California.
Excellent. And our special
Ricardo and I are keeping it warm for
listen, I'm also currently in South Texas with my family, so I'm just feeling very sorry for our special guest, who is probably in the coldest climate at the moment, Patricia Lyons. Trisha, where are you and what are you up to?
I am in Alexandria, Virginia. I hadn't thought of it as a cold part of the country, but compared to the rest of the conversation, maybe it's a little chilly here. I am working as an associate priest at Church of the Epiphany, which is right downtown D.C. We're about two blocks from the White House.
Well, welcome, Trisha. We're so glad you're here. This, in fact, is our 52nd episode of Popping Collars. And today's topic, we began actually in the 1990s as a concept hatched by a researcher and bilingual secretary for Amnesty International, and her name was Joanne, and it has now grown into a 7-book, 8-movie franchise, a theme park, limitless merchandise, and a new prequel film released just this fall entitled Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I am, of course, talking about the Potterverse, created by British author J.K. Rowling, which began as the story of Harry Potter, the boy wizard who lived, and now appears to be expanding and growing into new areas. Some of you out there may be wondering, how is this podcast 52 episodes old without doing Harry Potter? Isn't this low-hanging fruit? Trust me, this has been on the list for a long time, but we wanted to have a strong peg, like the recent film, and a great guest. And that is where the good Reverend Dr. Lyons comes in. Trisha, you have spent a long time in the Potterverse. You have led numerous workshops and series across the country on Potter and faith, and you actually have a forthcoming book, Teaching Faith with Harry Potter. So I don't think this outs anyone here, but age-wise, none of us can claim to have discovered Harry Potter as an obsessive middle school student. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. No.
So, yeah. Trisha, I'm going to start with you. When did you discover this world and what hooked you?
Well, let's see. For about 20 years, I've worked in high schools. I started in a public high school, and then I was in an all-girls school, and then an Episcopal co-ed day school. And I will say something that probably makes a lot of sense, Betsy, to you working in high school ministry, which is the spiritual desert that is homecoming week.
Can I just get an amen? Amen for that. Yes.
For anyone who cares about high school being a lot more like Lord of the Rings and less like Lord of the Flies, we hate homecoming week because no matter how funky, cool, progressive, whatever your high school is, like, we all have this like retrograde week where there's like one sport and one game and you have to have a date and it's about a dress. Long story short is 1 year, probably 4 years ago, 3-4 years ago, my high school decided the theme was going to be Harry Potter. And I'd never read any Harry Potter. I'd never seen any of the movies. They'd come and gone in the theaters. I thought this was two bad things happening. One, the Harry Potter people who hadn't given it up yet. They got to rule the worst week spiritually ever. And right, this was a recipe for like serious prayer, like on your knees. No surprises, those of you who are Harry Potter fans, Like the kids all come. Betsy, you know this. This is your world. Sunday night, they've decorated the whole school, right? And you got to be really in that crowd. Monday morning, they had transferred the school into Hogwarts, which I didn't know what it was. That sounded like a kind of sexually transmitted disease, actually. I'm just going to say that. But anyway, so you had people talking to each other of different races, different social classes. It was all about this narrative, right? The narrative literally took over the school. And even the homecoming dance, which is usually just like, wow, I'm like a walking contraceptive, right? And but it was like a Yule ball. And like there was fabric everywhere, which is like overwhelming. It was like people looked like they were wearing drapes. I'd never seen so much fabric on teenagers before. But fabric was in because ball was in. And the lights were on and people were dancing. Like, what is happening in my universe? Harry Potter took on homecoming and won. It's everything if you care about souls, no matter what your religion is or spiritual tradition. It's everything we want. And it all happened. And I've never seen it. Here's the thing. It changes communities. I saw it. This is not a faith-based love of Harry Potter. This is like evidence-based, a community that has so many walls, finish the week with so many bridges. And I'm like, I got to know this narrative.
Ricardo, where are you on the Potter scale of interest? Friend.
On the spectrum of Potter, you know, I read all seven books, and I think I jumped in at the third one, but it all blurs to me after number four a little bit because the kind of narrative takes over. Mm-hmm. So I love the third book the best, Prisoner of Azkaban. Like there's something in one of the books where they're going around at night trying to find something, and I just see it so clearly. Even after the movies, I don't know how the movies looked, but it trips my trigger. I love it. There's something about magic and narrative and like who you are as a person and how that helps you define your destiny and be a good person in a bad world.
I'm in the zone of having a child who is nine, who loves them, right? Who really wanted more Harry Potter stuff for Christmas, aside from her Ravenclaw infinity scarf that she received. But she really, to discover them through someone else's eyes, and I am the total, you know, NPR nerd mom who's like, you have to read every book before you watch the movie. So we've been doing that. So she's on the second to last book. And so she's almost done. But it really took, like, I tried it a little earlier. Like, we read together book number one. And I don't think she was really into it. And I think it was, you're right, Ricardo, it's that book three. Things start getting a little dark. She needed to be a little older, I think, to really go on the journey with it.
Goblet of Fire is really where it takes that hard left turn, right?
Yeah. Like,
spoilers, Lord, everybody.
Sorry, 20-year-old book.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, the death of Cedric Diggory is like one of the most powerful sort of deaths that I've seen in pop culture. And it, you know, it really forced kids to really process like what the stakes were.
Well, and the best rule really for talking right with kids of any age about death or just the big stuff is to wait and respond to their questions. I think people really stress themselves out trying to figure how to talk about death. Like they're scripting, like they're writing a play. And they just want to get it right. Yeah. And they don't want to do any damage. So that's like the Hippocratic Oath is like their North Star in these conversations. And the truth is you can do wrong by trying to do too much, right? So what I find with young people, by letting them just read the story and have the experience and then just be a person that says, I've read it too. And their questions are going to be age appropriate by design. You know, your answers may not be, but you're really in a hole if you start talking first.
I do wonder, I don't have kids and I know Cedric Diggory, yes, that's dark, but it gets even more intense. The death that really got me the most out of all the books was Snape's. It was like, it was our Snape, you know, who we love to hate. That really flipped me out, like injustice and evil.
Let's take Prisoner of Azkaban, okay? So the first time, even in the movies too, where the movies start to get dark, even visually the movies get darker, lots more gray, lots more black. What I love, though, is in Prisoner of Azkaban, you also have Professor Lupin, who's assigned a kind of wounded healer, right? And the opposite of Umbridge later on in the series, you know, who's so well put together, or Rita Skeeter, or all these are the Minister of Magic. And he teaches the Patronus charm in the same book where things get really dark. And I see that as a really sort of a compassionate place in the seven books where she puts the teaching of the Patronus Charm. How do you repel Dementors? So in the very third book where she introduces both specific darkness, but also the kind of atmospheric evil of a Dementor, something that sucks the joy away from you. She has you learn in that book, in that year at Hogwarts, the way to repel Dementors. A scene that is as close to what it means to teach people how to pray as anything I've read in religious education of any faith, which is to have someone older look at someone younger and say, hold in your mind an image of love, the most powerful love you can imagine, which for Harry and the series is sacrificial love. And you can't kill a Dementor, right? That's a cool trivia fact. Dumbledore says it more than once. You can't kill them. You can just repel them. So, I mean, that's the world, isn't it? I mean, we cannot change the outcome of an election. We cannot change some of our health situation. It's all about repelling the Dementor first away from your face so it stops sucking the life out of you. So you have enough room to breathe and your memory goes deeper and you push the Dementor further away and there's enough room to live. And for Rowling, like, that's enough. That is enough of spiritual practice to get enough room to breathe, to get enough room to live. And that's the lesson you get. And you get it when the books get darks, you know, and you get it and you get the charm too, ridiculous, you know. They're going to talk about things that are scary, but she puts in a lesson in the same book that says things are going to get rough. But remember, you know, some of our fears are ridiculous. And I'm going to teach you this charm. So you get the Patronus charm and you get ridiculous in the same story. And you probably don't realize in your reader that you are packing for a dark journey coming. But she lets you pack. You know, she doesn't leave you alone to face death.
I got to admit, I was too cool for Harry Potter for a long time. But once you see Alfonso Cuarón's like vision of Harry Potter and that Dementor hand coming around that train door and that close-up of it and how twisted and wicked that shot looks, you start to realize, oh my gosh, these kids are in for something. And that's where you know that you are on a journey that's going to take you somewhere into deeper into mystery, I think. That's the thing that really compels me about this is that by the time you get to book five or book six, now you're in the mystery along with the kids.
Well, it's the power of narrative. And if you just look around there a little, do you remember in Facebook a couple of years ago, it used to be called your wall, right? And mm-hmm. Did you notice that at some point we went from calling it a wall to a timeline? I mean, not to get too geeky here, but like there's a philosopher who, Charles Taylor, who writes a lot about secularization of our culture. And his book, The Secular Age, is just like a kind of go-to for doing philosophy. And one of the things he argues is that for hundreds and hundreds of years, we lived in what was called an enchanted world. You had a grand narrative, whether it was that there is a God or even for your national identities. And he just argues that in the modern period, and certainly the postmodern period, we're in a disenchanted age now. There just aren't, there's no trust in institutions. There's no trust in the narratives that come from institutions. You're not going to be anybody's fool. And as a result, people are starving for narrative because they've been told and educated that narratives are lies and they come from institutions which have more of a chance of hurting you or ignoring you or marginalizing you than they do of feeding you. So pack up your stuff and go. So you've got all these people who packed up their stuff and went, right? From religion, from a political party. So you're independent or you're unaffiliated or whatever. And you buy the Girl Scout cookies and you love other institutions that you think are not dangerous to the world, but most of them you're not interested in, but we lost the narrative. And that's where I feel like when I walk into a church full of people that want to hear about Harry Potter, I know they really want to hear about Harry Potter because they've either read it or they've heard, but I also know that they're absolutely hungry for grand narratives. We are wired for it. Our imagination is, Augustine was right. God, you have made us for yourself and we are restless until we rest in you. His whole thing is we are just restless, waiting for a narrative. But that longing to be part of something larger, I think drives a lot of the love for Harry Potter because that's also just a very engaging narrative. But I just think that we're in a cultural moment right now where people don't want to be anybody's fool. But as a result, they're then sort of nobody's follower. And they realize, wait, you got to be a little foolish to do a little following.
Wow. Well, and the cyclical nature too of things, you know, when these books were coming out in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. I mean, let's think back.
Right.
To, you know, 9/11, to all of the patriotism after that, and to what the world looks like living in fear. Because we've, we're very much in the wizarding world. You know, we don't get to venture much outside. There is a little bit of crossover towards the end where the prime minister is actually dealing with, you know, but the wizarding world is having its own crisis. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of living into that narrative. And I can remember some of that time really wanting to tune out from what was happening then. And I was ready to dive into something else and live in another narrative, whether it was the West Wing or whether it was Harry Potter or whatever's going on. And it's very interesting to find myself in somewhat of a similar situation at the moment, culturally. But I had also really forgotten about the big pushback from Christians against magic.
Right.
I'd forgotten about that until I went and started thinking about talking with you all today and how, you know, very much reminds me of conversations I've had with students whose families are anti-Halloween or, you know, or those sorts of concepts. You know, and when people refer to what Jesus does when I teach the miracles as magic, and I'm like, no, not magic. That's different. How do you hold those things together, my Christian faith, and also feeling the presence of something that isn't just smoke and mirrors that's happening in this book? There's something real, grounded, and true.
Magic for her is just a way to, going back to the Charles Taylor, in a secular age, she's trying to enchant the mind, like make people open doors that have been closed by rationality, by competition, by consumerism, certainly in first world countries, like so closed off that you really, the person next to you, like Hobbes and Locke were right, you know, centuries ago, you know, every man is to another a wolf. That's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And terrorism and everything else in the election has just brought out that side of us that we don't know whether the person next to us is our lunch or we're theirs. You know, I mean, that kind of stress. And the cortisol is high, the adrenaline is high, and Rowling says, okay. It's almost like the whole story is a disarming spell. And then you're in this place where you're like, just like Narnia, you had to go through and you had to go to Narnia, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, Aslan says to Lucy, I brought you here to know me here so that when you go back to London, you would know me there. I'd go by a different name. So in a sense, mm-hmm. Rowling has done what's been done before.
You were talking about narrative and how we're all hungry for narrative. And I'm not exactly sure what it is we're hungry for. And I agree with you. We want to pin our lives on something like what we were saying before, that gives us a sense that we are traveling somewhere, we are heading somewhere, and that the things we do have meaning. I remember the last book, and what struck me almost the most was how it became this, didn't it become this ragtag bunch of kids who had learned together how to fight the darkness, even though the adults weren't teaching them, that it became forbidden for a while there. So they had to teach each other and they became stronger for it. Neville like totally slays one of the really bad guys and it comes out of nowhere. And I thought, you know what? He was like the dork back when, but he became stronger and more his true self when he was in relationship with like-minded people and they had a common cause and they loved each other. And they fought together for something they believed in. And I don't know if that's maybe that's Christian, that's human, that's community, that's relationship. But I see it all as such a powerful message about, you know, maybe who we are separately and who we think we are or how small or little we are. If you can find a like-minded band of folks, you can find your truer self.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I have a question. I have a question about story. Because I think you're right. Like, I think we're wired for this, like to make meaning, to tell stories and to make meaning, right, out of the world around us. So I was actually listening to a podcast earlier today, and they were talking about the top 10 films of 2016 domestic box office. And they're all superhero movies, animated movies, sequels or prequels, all the top 10 in America, right? And so I know a little bit about comics. I know that there's one issue that's act one in comics and everything after it is act two. There's never an act three. There's never an ending. But I also know that things that captivate people and things that really draw in people are epics like Harry Potter, like Lord of the Rings, like Game of Thrones, clear definitive ending, even the ones that we don't necessarily know what their definitive ending is yet. Is there a difference between those two styles of storytelling? Because it feels like as Christians, like when we think of like these pop culture texts as scripture, when we look at our own scripture, there's a clear kind of story of the Gospels, and then there's everything that we live that's still a continuation of it. Like, we're still stuck in act two in some ways.
I like series that have a nice deep rabbit hole where there's always more to discover. I think that's why I like teaching the Bible, because even though I'm kind of coming with all this kind of arsenal that I have going on to my sophomores, I inevitably always learn something from them. There's always another way of thinking about it that I haven't gotten to. And I just saw Fantastic Beasts this past week, right? And so I walk out of there and I'm immediately on my phone. I'm on like Potter Wiki and I'm learning all of this other stuff, all this other background, all these other things that I didn't know. I like a heavy, detailed, a lot of background going on that still has a core that I can understand, that still has a heart and a center, a creamy nougat that I understand what's happening in the narrative. But I do like all the other things going on as well. Like Greg and I were talking earlier today, we're like, you know, what is Harry Potter a gateway for in other cultural mediums? You know, where do people go from the series and get fed as well? Is it a Game of Thrones? Is it a Tolkien? Is it a, you know, but none of those things kind of have that, you know, if you had a Game of Thrones homecoming, like you're not getting the same.
I don't want to go.
It's going to be rough. It's going to be a lot of detail, and there's going to be two guys in a corner who are going to debate whether the house sigil is correct.
No, but Betsy, why would you give Game of Thrones homecoming week when they have the whole year? Like homecoming
That's true.
That's a week off of middle school life.
That is true. That's a good point.
I think we have a need for both. We both need a narrative to get us through the day, like a grand narrative. And we also know, and when you go to your first funeral as a kid, you're like, wait a minute, it ends. So we actually have a desire for two things. We need a way to deal with the ending, and we need a way to deal with what can feel like Groundhog Day without an ending. Like, so not having an ending doesn't make life better. That's Voldemort. I just never want to die. So his whole life is like Groundhog Day with evil. So you feel as a kid, like, I actually need both things. I need a reason to keep going to school, doing middle age, doing senior citizen life, whatever I'm doing. And I need a way to handle when my narrative ends. And when you think about it, there's only two Bible verses in the whole Harry Potter series. 1 million words, 4,100 pages. And there's two Bible verses that come in book 7, the very end. And they're both on gravestones. And you remember the scene, it's Harry and Hermione are in the graveyard where his parents are buried. And they first find Dumbledore's family's grave. And there's the first Bible verse. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Words from Jesus. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So think about it. That's a verse about seeking, like seek well. So she's embracing that first part of you, right, Greg, that you were talking about, I think. That first part of you that wants to seek well. Think about your treasures, you know, follow the golden snitch, right? Duh. That's like a treasure floating in the air. Be a seeker, but pick that right, because what you pick will form you, right? Pick the right snitch, right? But then the second verse, right? Remember they go to Harry's parents' grave and the second verse on their gravestone? And for those of you who are like, Harry, you know, Harry Potter is all about witchcraft and pagan. Oh my gosh, Rowling gives you an entire scene of like Bible study in this graveyard. So I don't want to hear anything about her being some kind of like Wiccan or whatever, because that's just like not a thing that's happening. And he gets to his own parents' grave, and right on there, Corinthians, the last enemy to be defeated is death. Mm-hmm. That's a hard phrase. And J.K. Rowling is so committed to you not messing it up. She has Harry mess it up. He was like, wait a minute, the last enemy to be defeated is death. And the book says, wait a minute. He says, that's Death Eater language. Like, my parents weren't Death Eaters. He's totally confused. Like, wait, my parents didn't want to die? So J.K. Rowling, like, putting a hand in a puppet, puts her whole faith right into Hermione, who goes, Harry, I don't think that means what Death Eaters mean. I hope you realize this is like a total sermon, right? And Harry's like, duh, what? She's like, I think maybe, possibly it means life after death, Harry. Do you get it? So don't miss that Rowling has waited 4,000 pages to just hit you with two verses to demonstrate that faith offers truth to the two parts of a person. You want to know how to seek, and you want to know how it ends. And her whole thing is, if you seek true treasure, you will find resurrection in it. And how does this end? It doesn't. Death dies, and you live through it. So it's like the story says, yes, we want, Greg, you're right. There are two kinds of narratives. And the Christian story says this story addresses and liberates you in both.
Choose something. This time it'll be me, like the staff at the video store. You know, you get to. Right.
That was the reason to go to Blockbuster. You're just
totally.
Like, I want to know that Sandy actually watched Attack of the Killer Tomatoes,
exactly.
And like, recommended it,
and actually probably hasn't, but wants to be that employee who put up Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Which, listening audience, if you have not seen this experiment in felonious murder special effects circa 1972 in the basement of the guy down the street who's never smelt right. This is your movie.
So Greg, you have our employee pick.
Yeah, I do. And I had to go back and forth on this. I had to go back and forth on this because last time Liz talked about another podcast, My Favorite Murder, which she was really into. And I was about to do a podcast, but then I just finished watching a show on Netflix. And I was thinking about our conversation today. And I think that this is like the dark side of what it is that we are just talking about. I just watched a show called 3%. 3%.
Ooh,
it is on Netflix.
Yes.
It is a Brazilian show, so it's in Portuguese. Although I guess you could probably watch it in English, but then you wouldn't have like the actors' voices or anything. You have like dubbed voices and stuff. Right. But it is about 20-year-olds who are in Brazil, and they go through a process, starting to sound familiar, right? A process where some of them are chosen. And some of them are not, but 3% of the 20-year-olds that grow up in inland, 3% of them are chosen to live a life of comfort and ease and wealth offshore. But you have to go through this sort of interview process and even torturous process. There's like, you know, they make them wait in a basement for days on end with very little food and stuff like that. So it's one of
it's
these
like the Hunger Games in Brazil,
it
right?
Is. It's like the Hunger Games. So it's one of these like post-apocalyptic, like, yeah. You know, YA, very much like in the vein of like Divergent and Hunger Games and stuff like that. But it's all about wealth. It's all about like who are the chosen ones that will live a life of luxury and who are the ones that will have to go back inland and live in the city. You earn your spot based on the decisions that you make during this process. Wow. And it forces you to make horrible decisions.
That's like Black Mirror kind of stuff.
But I gotta say, it was really compelling. Some great performances. I love Netflix because every now and then, you know, they're not afraid to just say, okay, we need content. So here's a Brazilian show. You know about
right. You
kids.
Can only show you can only show Frozen so many times, right?
Exactly.
Sure.
But then it's like that you could like pull a muscle, like you go from the Frozen marathon to just like you're in Brazil and you're just like, yeah. Greg, way to mix it up. I mean,
nice.
Well, there you go. You know, Harry Potter is all about hope. 3%, not so much hope, but it is a good watch. So there you go.
Excellent. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Poppin' Collars. You can find Poppin' Collars on Facebook, on our website. You can also find us wherever you might have your podcast needs met. We are also on iTunes and all that. Please leave us a review. We always like those things. You can also find us on Episcopal Cafe, where we are a part of the Episcopal Consortium of podcasts, if you will. So we love Episcopal Cafe, and we know that you will too. Check them out for all of your Episcopal news needs. And I just got to say, thank you, Greg. Thank you, Ricardo. And a special big thank you to our special guest, Trisha. Thank you so much for joining us.
Keep those colors popped.
Pop, pop.
Wait.
I stole your line, Betsy.
I know you did. What?